finally, without further ado, we have our speaker for the closing, and I welcome Mary Pat.
Hello, I'm Mary Pat, and I'm a compulsive overeater. What? How's that? Can you hear better? How's that? Better? Can you hear me now? Are we in a Verizon ad? Can you hear me now? Is that okay, guys? Okay. So I'm actually Mary Pat A, because there's actually a Mary Pat G also in program, which for years I was the only Mary Pat, and then she came along, and now I have to be Mary Pat A. But there you go. I'm happy to share the name. So I am Mary Pat. I'm a compulsive overeater and a bulimic. And I'm so grateful to be here. The birthday party for me, I have so many remembrances of where in my abstinence it has been an absolute lifeline for me. And I remember there were, so I'm 18 years in program. I have 17 years of abstinence from bulimia. I have 10 years of abstinence from sugar as of January 10th, 2002. So just 10 years of that. And I am 40 pounds down from my top weight. Which I got to my top weight in program because I am a binge eater through and through, first and foremost, a compulsive binge eater. And so when I stopped my bulimic activities like over-exercising, like vomiting, well, guess what? I gained weight. But that was the first abstinence, and that was my path. And then, so I'll get to that in a second. But what would happen is, and I'm also a slow learner, and my willingness to do the actions that it takes for recovery at various stages has always been a reaction of how bad is my back burning against the wall? How badly am I suffering? And then depending on how badly I'm suffering, and then hearing the message of hope from people at meetings would get me willing to do the actions I needed to take. So there were a couple years when I would come to the OA birthday party just in depression, in misery. I just wasn't feeling connected to program. I didn't really have the money, and something would get me here, willing to pay whatever the registration fee was. And from the moment, from the Friday night entertainment, and then there's just, for me, a magic of recovery that would happen through the course of the Friday night, Saturday night, the meetings and whatnot. And then I would, it would re-energize my program. So I have a deep and utter gratitude to the birthday party, and I hope that it can offer the same to anyone else, especially those who may be struggling. So my story is, so I loved sugar from the get-go. I remember just loving sugar and sweet things as a four-year-old. I remember going to my grandmother's house, and I could care less about the people. It was about, where's her candy jar? And I remember she actually complained to my mother about that. You know, all Mary Pat does is run to the candy bar, candy dish when she comes here. And I'm like, uh-huh. And because I was a very active child, and because I am tall, it seems like I was always tall. So the combination was, it just, weight was not a problem for me as a youngster. I was very lucky in that respect. And it was about the age of 15, I think I should also mention my father is an alcoholic, and it's always amazing to me how many people who, over the years, that people in this program have parents or relatives who are alcoholics. I definitely think there's that genetic link. Has to do with sugar, I think, but be that as it may, I too am a child of an alcoholic, and have that ism in my family. And so I was 15. All I know is, at the age of around 15, I started to be aware of, more conscious of the feelings of not fitting in. I was conscious of my girlfriends had boyfriends and I didn't. So much of I have always had this lifelong quest to get the guy and to be good enough for the guy. And I equated that as, because I was tall, I said I could never have any fat on me because no guy would want me because I'm ugly, and so I have to have a perfect body. And so once I made this decision, that was, you know, I just feel like I signed my death warrant, because what happened was I would get depressed and I would go to food for comfort. And again, a lot of this realization is in looking back, but at the time, it's just what I did. And when I worked at McDonald's when I was 16, I would come, you know, when I was there, that's where I did a lot of sneak eating and stealing eating. And so they had corridors between, you know, there's the area where the customers are, and then there's corridors where they have locker rooms where you can put on your uniform. And they had, like, scads of their danishes and, you know, all that food and stuff, and I would, like, steal stuff out of there as I was walking by and scarf it, you know, while I'm in this dark hallway, not near people, and then shove remnants in my pockets. And, like, it was all about don't let people see what I'm doing, but, you know, because it was all about putting on that show for letting the world think I was one thing, but really I was behaving and doing this other thing. So, and I started to, age 15 again is the first time I became aware of wanting to diet to lose 10 pounds, you know. And I just wanted to be, you know, the short, cute, skinny girlfriend that my friends were. And I've heard so many gems this weekend that reminded me of my story. And it's just, whatever I was, it just wasn't good enough. It wasn't cute enough. I always wanted to be like them. And I didn't understand why they didn't have the obsession with food, why they could be at parties, and were other people not thinking about the food table? Like, I couldn't comprehend any modicum of freedom from thought of food, obsession of food, thought of eating, thought about not eating, thing, you know, I just couldn't even comprehend what life was like without that. So, so I started to, you know, I thought I could control it, and I started to, I forget who introduced me to vomiting, bulimia, which I thought I would go to my grave without mentioning that word, because it was so disgusting to me. It was, you know, it was not something someone with my upbringing would do. You know what I mean? When I say that, air quotes, would, you know, someone like me doesn't do this. And I was completely ashamed of it, but I felt like I had to do it because it was my desperate attempt to control my weight. And so I tried it, you know, and again, I thought it was something I could do and then just stop. You know, I did it once, and then before I knew it, you know, then it was like maybe a couple months later, then it was once a month, then it was once a week, and it grew into its own cycle of uncontrollability. So I went to college and at Bowling Green State University. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And I just love that because so much of the Alcoholics Anonymous story started around Akron and Cleveland and stuff. Like, yeah! But, like, I take pride in that. Like, I have something to do with it. No, but I just really dig that connection. So I went to college, and in college is when things got really out of control. I was just binging. On the one hand, I was going to classes, getting the grades, getting good grades. I was working at the local TV station. I was like the chosen one. I was the leader. People saw me as the successful leader. You know, that was like the image that they saw. But the other part of my life was we would go to breakfast with our dorm friends. They would come back, go to the rooms. I would go to the candy machine. I would buy several things. I was always looking furtively to make sure I wasn't being discovered. I would shove things in my pocket. I would eat them. Going back to the room, I would then wait out the bathrooms to make sure, you know, the coast was clear. And when I could get in there, I would, you know, make myself throw up. And it was just so disgusting. And, oh, my God, it's like, you know, this is insanity. Like, just describing this behavior, it's insanity. I didn't see it as insanity at the time. It just was what it was. But after a year of this was the first time I said to my mother, Mom, I'm in trouble. And, you know, so I tried therapy. And I mention these things just because there's so much. The answers are in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have been, they always will be. And there's so much of my story that I feel resonates. But I'll just mention it because, you know, so I've tried these outside things without recovery. And so things worked or seemed to work for a while. So therapy, you know, I just remember when I graduated and the guy's like, you're fine. You're, you know, you're they didn't use the word recovery, but like, whatever, whatever, you're okay. And I'm inside, I was terrified of living. And I remember thinking, no, I'm not okay. But okay, they're sending me out into this world to go live life. And I was just terrified. And the next thing I know, you know, it was only a matter of time before I was binging again. And then after I would start to gain weight when I was binging so much, then I would, you know, start purging again. So it's like one more time, this cycle of this insanity would start. And then I thought, when I moved to California, that would change it. And I'm like, I will never change a toilet in Los Angeles. And so I moved out here, and it was, I think, 2 weeks, and there was like some earthquake or something that happened, if we were on 89 or 90. And I started eating again, and then as I started eating more and more and going to the food for comfort, and then as I started to gain weight, all of a sudden I had to make myself throw up, and that started that monkey again. And with roommates, it was all about stealing their food and eating, you know, so much that it was like just not... It was stealing. Yeah, it was take their stuff and then, oops, I took half the box. Well, I'll go buy a new box and try and take out half again so that they won't notice. And oops, I took too much. I better go buy another box. I mean, like that kind of rigmarole. And then I tried another therapist and I remember her saying, Mary Pat, can't you just like go for a walk? Can't you, you know, like these things that sounded perfectly like they made sense. And I remember looking at her with this utter demoralization of, no, like, I didn't say this to her, but in my head it was like, I can't. I remember before program, it was like I was guided by an automaton that I would say to myself as I'm going home, I don't want to go to the refrigerator, I don't want to go to the refrigerator, I don't want to go to the refrigerator, I'm not going to go to the refrigerator this time. And I would walk in and I would go straight to the refrigerator and open it up. So this disconnect of the one being saying, don't do this, and the other one like, I have no control over this. So what happened? So this is sort of the cycle of my life through the years. I had somehow decided that, like, I'll grow out of this. I know I'll grow out of it. And I'm sure by age 27, I'll be fine. And when age 27 rolled around and I was still plagued by this disease, that's when I was alarmed. And I was like, oh, my God. I had heard about Overeater Anonymous. I believe there was a book or something. I remember a book with a red cover. But I was like, I will not need a 12-step program. I saw 12-step programs as being something weak. My father had tried AA as far as I'd known, but he was, you know, he didn't get it at that time. And to me, it was like, I was strong. I didn't need it, you know, and I would not need it. So what happened was, my Eskimo was, I was working for a woman. I was working out of her house. And she had a kitchen, and she's like, you're welcome to anything in my kitchen. And I'm like, okay. And it was only a matter of time before, you know, I was binging, doing the sneak thing, and I even was trying the, you know, replacing thing, and it's just such an insane way to, this obsession, you know, while trying to work, while trying to, and I was, my life was, I could not, even our methods stopped working, and I couldn't even make myself sick anymore. I was just bloated. I was utterly demoralized. And she came to me one day and said, Mary Pat, you know, I made a thing of cookies for my son, and I had to explain to him why we didn't have enough to take to his class. Because I couldn't eat just, you know, a couple cookies. I eat 12 or 14 was like the beginning of a serving for me. And I was so embarrassed, and she's like, you know what, the kitchen is off limits to you. And I was so embarrassed. But oddly, she had been in program, and you know, I hadn't seen her since. I don't know when people come and stick and when they don't. But all I know is, for me, she looked at me and she smiled and she said, "Why don't you try Overeaters Anonymous? It would be great for you." And I was like, I don't know why I like didn't slap her, but I, you know what? She gave me the phone number of a friend. I called that person. I went to my first meeting. I hated it. I did not, this was not like the cool crowd that I wanted to be part of, you know, and I was like, I have this busy life. I'm trying to write a screenplay and I need time to do that. Forget the fact that every time I sit down to the computer, all I do is get up and go eat. That's beside the point. But You know, I just hated OA, and yet I heard what many of us here try 6 meetings. I was like, that sounds reasonable. And try 6 meetings before you decide. But there was something in that first meeting that made me go to the second meeting as well. And there was something in that second meeting that made me willing to try. And this is like how my willingness comes. I come unwilling, but with there's a tiny glimmer of hope. And in the voices and the eyes and the presence and the beingness of these people in these meetings, there was something that they had that I wanted. And it was Wade. For many people, it was Wade. For me, what really resonated, and I think why I feel bad that I didn't gain 100 pounds, is because what resonates with me is the people who've lost a lot of weight. And in the beginning, that's all I cared about. Tell me who lost the weight and is keeping it up. That's who I want as my sponsors. That was all that was important to me. But what these people also had was this inexplicable ease with life, and they were talking honestly about their foibles, and they were, you know, that thing in their eyes, that's all I can say, just this light in their eyes. And that was an attractiveness all its own, too. So, you know, they said, what I kept hearing was, for people who were struggling, you know, in the beginning, what they did is they went to a meeting every day. I was like, oh, no. And but I was willing. I wanted what they had. So I started going to a meeting every single morning at the Unitarian Church in Studio City. And Saturday mornings was the kitchen sink, and Sunday mornings was Serenity Sunday. And so I was going to between 6 and 8 meetings a week. They said, get a sponsor and start working the steps. I was like, okay. And it took me a couple sponsors and 2 years into program to find what, for me, I've had some great sponsorship, but this one particular sponsor just helped me so much, and so much of what I was taught through this sponsor has stuck with me, and it's what I find myself passing on to sponsees. And he was in AA also, and his sponsor was in AA and OA as well. And so my sponsors have always, I've been brought up from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the AA 12 and 12 as like our main literature that we use. And so that's what I use when I sponsor as well. And when I would call him, it was a gay male, because I have to mention that because, you know, I really do believe, yes, women should sponsor women, men should sponsor men, and, you know, in this case, it didn't matter because, you know, he was a gay guy. But what was also important to me is, you know, when I first saw him speak at a meeting, before, like, he said very much, there was this massive judgment, like, this person has nothing to share. I mean, his voice is funny and whatever. Like, it was like I was ready to shut it off. And by the end of his share, I was like in tears and my heart was moved and I was touched. And before long, I asked him to be my sponsor. So that's like the funny way God works. And when I would call him, like, oh, I'm going to meetings and I still can't stay abstinent. And very often, more often than not, he would say, go get your 12 and 12. Go get your big book. And he would keep pointing me to the literature. And I'm so grateful for that looking back, because it was a reminder, once again, that the program's in the literature. The recovery's in the literature. And one thing that stuck in my mind is in step 3, I think, and forgive me if I misquote anything because whatever, you understand. But you'll get the gist, I hope. But I think it's in step 3 in the AA 12 and 12. And there's this part, sure enough, and it says, going, you know, sponsor will point out that going to a few meetings is very good indeed. It's like, oh, yeah, going to a few meetings is very good indeed. And then, but, and you say, what's that word, but? It's a big but. It's bound to be a far cry from permanent abstinence and a contented and useful life. And this is like, oh. And it says that's just where the remaining steps of Overeaters Anonymous come in. And I'm like, oh. And it says nothing short of continuous action on these as a way of life will bring the much desired result. And then he'd say, what kind of action? Does it say occasional action? I'd say, No, it says continuous action. Right. As a way of life. And so it's like he would draw it into my head this way. And I was really grateful for this way of, like, right, there it is. It's like that's the good and bad news of it, you know? The bad news, but the good news, you know? And he also talked a lot about, you know, this is a disease, and as a disease, you know, how do we cure diseases or deal with diseases? They take medicine. And so a lot of times it's like, well, if you're suffering or you're struggling with your abstinence, you just need a little more OA medicine. And the OA medicine is the tools and the steps of Overeaters Anonymous. And there was some, I just liked that getting off the blame game. Like, I'm not terrible. I'm not a loser. I'm not a failure. I just am a really sick person, and my disease is really doing everything it can to stay alive, and so I need more OA medicine. And what else? So I'd heard from a sponsor that, you know, abstinence is the most important thing on the planet without exception. And that was a helpful thing for me to hear, because there were so many times when I thought, no, this other thing is important, or my job's more important. And it's like, no, abstinence is the most important thing on the planet without exception. And, you know, I had a sponsor tell me, look, if all you do today is stay abstinent and you do nothing else, that's a successful day. And I was like, what? You know, no, you know, because the way I define success is all this to-do list, da-da-da-da-da, you know. But it's like if all I was staying in bed, but I stayed abstinent, that was a miraculous, successful day. So I appreciated, you know, being reminded of that as well. So the thing about, you know, willingness, so my first abstinence was from bulimia, and that, you know, I was eating when I came to meetings in the beginning. I was still eating and throwing up, and so my will would have been to just stop eating as much and then cut all the bad habits altogether. But guess what? Like, for me, step one in the powerlessness over my disease, and then through step two, and then step three, putting my life in, you know, into God's hands, I had to put away what my picture of what I wanted my body to look at each point along recovery and how I wanted it to go. I had to like, okay, God, and it was like a real letting. It was hard, but I just I just knew that I had to trust that God had a plan, and even though it might not look like my plan, I just wanted to believe that it would bring me to a better place. And so I just remember the day that I had binged, and I wanted to throw up, and I was laying on my bed, and I, for whatever reason on that day, I was willing to call instead, and I called this girl. I said, if I get up off this bed, I know I'm going to go straight to the bathroom. I know it. And she talked to me, I think it was like for 2 hours, and I didn't throw up that day. And then it's like I did that one day at a time. And after 8 months and I gained weight, I got up to 170. I picked a sponsor who had lost 80 pounds and was keeping it off. And so it's like, if you want what they have, do what they did. And so she taught me how to eat moderately. And so I just tried to mimic how she ate, and that helped me at that time. And the thing I remember about losing weight is whenever I focused on losing weight, I always gained. And whenever I focused on showing up, being of service, working the program, being sponsoring, just get into life and get out of myself, that's when, after a period of time, I'd look back and like, oh my God, a couple pounds came off. So it came off way slower than I would have liked, and it came off when I was just not thinking about that, but focusing instead on recovery and while still eating abstinent. I mean, I hope that makes sense. It's like, it's not, you know, it's like, yes, you have to be the abstinence and the food plan, but yeah, it just wasn't in my time and on my design. And I want to say something about, so the abstinence from sugar. So the way that came about was, so in the Big Book talks about, you know, our alcohol, and which I translate to alcoholic foods, And so I had to say, you know, what are the foods that give me that, you know, the allergy of the body that triggers the obsession of the mind? And I've shared this before, but, you know, the one thing that I loved about OA, but which I also think makes it challenging in OA, is that there are so many different abstinences, and there are people who say, you know, some people eat all foods more moderately. Some people, you know, abstain from certain foods. So I kept hearing that I wanted to be the all foods more moderately person. And I, my sponsor, and this is another thing I forget, I wanted to do sometimes what people, they've been in a program 11 years, so I wanted to jump ahead and get where they were get at 11 years. So for many years, I just wasn't willing to give up sugar. That's the bottom line. I would have periods of abstinence, but then I'd take it back. And the other thing that would happen was I never really knew an abstinent date, and because it, you know, when that small, still voice, like rigorous honesty, like I knew in my heart that I was just, who was I fooling? But, and there were, you know, I was still going to meetings, I was still learning a lot, I wasn't binging the way I used to. I mean, like, there were so many good things, and yet there was still, it was still my, it was vague, the food was still controlling me somewhat, I was still obsessed sometimes at work, and moreover, as the years passed on, I was being a real bitch. When I would eat sugar, like invariably, like 3 minutes later, I was snapping at someone. And so there was, it's taken all these tolls. And people, you know, so I was like, okay, my abstinence is 3 meals a day with nothing in between. Well, then I'd have something in between. So then my sponsor would say, okay, well, let's make your abstinence. And, you know, now we say food plan, but at the time it was just one thing. We didn't, like, specify. So let's say your abstinence is 3 meals a day with something in between then. Okay. And then I'd have two things. Okay. Well, let's say your abstinence is 3 meals a day with 2 snacks in between. Well, I'd, you know what I mean? Whatever it was, I'd break it. That's the bottom line. Whatever it was, I'd break it. And I spent a lot of time feeling very separate in OA because of this. And, wow, time goes fast. And, but I knew I needed, I knew OA was the last house on the block for me. I knew it was the only thing that worked. It was the only thing that would give me a chance at living. And so in spite of everybody kind of giving me the way out, the truth is for me that alcohol and sugar, and for me, alcohol is filled with sugar, so it's hard for me to have an abstinence that doesn't include, an abstinence from sugar that doesn't include alcohol. And I knew that those things were my alcoholic foods. And so for whatever reason, the day I got fired, I went to my friend's house, and that night I had a piece of cake. That was January 10th in 2002, and that was my last compulsive bite of sugar. And the thing that's so amazing to me is I don't know what was different about that day that was different from the many times I would try and be abstinent and then break it after 30 days or break it after 60 days. But all I know is I kept coming back, you know, and they say, keep coming back and don't leave before the miracle happens. And that's, I think, so critical to know. And the other thing is that this abstinence was the last, I took the cue from the big book, because AA's birth date is June 10th of 1935, and I noticed, so that's their birth date, right? And I noticed that in Dr. Bob's story, you know, he has his last drink, and he says, that was June 10th, 1935, and that was my last drink. As I write, nearly 4 years have passed. I was like, wait a minute. It wasn't like the next day when he had perfect non-drinking abstinence. It's like, no, the moment we take our last bite, our last whatever, that's our abstinence state. And oddly, that's the only date that's ever stuck in my mind to remember. So, I don't know. I found some freedom in that. So, what do I want to say? Just that I truly do feel that I've grown up in Overeaters Anonymous. I keep trying, in spite of falling down, I keep persisting, you know, I do it way imperfectly, and I'm just so grateful when other people say that they do it imperfectly too, and they just keep showing up. And for me, the miracle, I used to think that life would not be worth living without my mother's Nestle's Toll House chocolate chip cookies. And truly, I truly thought it would not be worth living. And the miracle for me is that abstinence, you know, in program and working all these steps and whatever happens to our minds, whatever this spiritual experience is that happens, is it's just miraculous. And something I want to say before time winds down. Is that 2 minutes yet? Okay, so like God. I want to mention God because something that's been really crucial to days that I have more freedom, and the freedom is not just of the food and the freedom from this compulsion and freedom from that anxiety, but it's just a freedom of being and a freedom of living. And also, I have found that conversely, I can have abstinence and still have anxiety and nuttiness, but one thing that really seems to help it is the more I connect with my higher power. And in program, and I love step two work, you know, they say, if your higher power isn't working for you, either borrow someone else's until you find one that does, and also like write a want ad for God. And what I love is, that sounded so hokey to me in the beginning. Like, what? You have got to be kidding. And it doesn't matter if things sound hokey or goofy or whatever. We just do it anyway, and we find it works. And so all I know is, again, I just was willing to take actions no matter how goofy they sound or whatever. And today I do have a higher power that is a really, for me, a loving entity. And it's, and I've, you know, reminding that, like, in the literature somewhere, like, our real, the right dependence is our dependence upon God. And it's not the same as over-depending on, like, other people. And, but also just that this is such a we program. And anytime I'm isolating or trying to do it myself, like, I know I'm on a rocky road. And that's where I'm just, like, so grateful for service or sponsorship and being sponsored. So, thanks for being here, everybody, and I hope that everybody has a great, they take whatever recovery they've gotten here, and it just grows and blossoms, and thanks for letting me share. Thank you, Mary and Pat. So, we have one more thing left to do. We're going to bring Joe up here. We all like to win prizes. We're going to do the prize drawing, the 50-50 drawing, and all that good stuff. So hang on.